So we're in Matthew chapter 20. Please turn there. We'll be working our way through the end of the chapter. And we're a bit early, I think, considering the coming chapter is about the triumphal entry. I don't know exactly when Easter is this year, but we're going to be entering Jerusalem before they celebrate the entry in Jerusalem. So we hope, actually, the goal is to continue through Matthew until we finish it. And I think the goal for today is actually to finish chapter 20. So I'm going to read it. And you may not at first see how all of these different sections are related, but hopefully by the end of today you'll see why they're actually constructed this way and put together in this fashion. So Matthew 20, beginning in verse 17. And as Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside. And on the way, he said to them, "See, we are going up to Jerusalem. And the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified. And he will be raised on the third day." Then the mother of the sons of Zebedee came up to him with her sons, and kneeling before him, she asked him for something. And he said to her, "What do you want?" And she said to him, "Say that these two sons of mine are to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left, in your kingdom." And Jesus answered, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink?" They said to him, "We are able." Then he said to them, "You will drink my cup, but to sit at my right hand and at my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father." And when the 10 heard it, they were indignant at the two brothers. But Jesus called them to him and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. It shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be your slave, even as the Son of Man came, not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." And as they went out of Jericho, a great crowd followed him, and behold, there were two blind men sitting by the roadside. And when they heard that Jesus was passing by, they cried out, "Lord, have mercy on us, Son of David." The crowd rebuked them, telling them to be silent. But they cried out all the more, "Lord, have mercy on us, Son of David." And stopping, Jesus called them and said, "What do you want me to do for you?" And they said to him, "Lord, let our eyes be opened." And Jesus, in pity, touched their eyes, and immediately they recovered their sight and followed him. So as we look at this last section in Matthew 20, these last few sections, we see in the distance the shadow of Jerusalem kind of hanging over the entire passage. We know that's where Jesus is going to finally arrive in chapter 21. We know that in beginning in chapter 19 that Matthew told us that Jesus had begun his journey to Jerusalem. He left Galilee and he went to Judea. And now we see even in this passage they are going up to Jerusalem. They're approaching the city on a hill, the holy city, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it. And we see Jesus even predicting his fate as he goes up to Jerusalem, to this great and holy city. I think there are, from at least the section in the ESV, how it splits this up, there's kind of three distinct sections of this passage. We do see, first of all, that Jesus is telling the disciples what is going to happen to him in Jerusalem. And then we see, I think, in the second section, why that is going to happen. And finally, in that third section, those last few verses, I think we see how it is that those disciples are actually going to understand what is going to happen to Jesus. So I think that's kind of a way in which you can hang on to the contents of this section. We want to look at what Jesus says is going to happen, why that's going to happen, and how it is that the disciples understand it. So first of all, the journey to Jerusalem. Matthew tells us that Jesus is going up to Jerusalem. And then we see Jesus telling his disciples that he is going up to Jerusalem. So where is Jesus going? Jerusalem. Why is he going up to Jerusalem? Because Jerusalem is a city that is on a hill. It is a city that is lifted up. So no matter where you come from, you will always go up to Jerusalem, because all the other areas below Jerusalem are below Jerusalem. So you always go up to Jerusalem and you sing the Psalms of Ascent. And then when you leave Jerusalem, which direction do you go? Down. So Jesus is going up to Jerusalem. Why is he going to Jerusalem? Well, it's the Passover, right? That's what we're going to see in just, you know, the very next passage. He's going to celebrate the Passover. What do the disciples think Jesus is going to do in Jerusalem? He's the king. And Jerusalem is not just a high and holy city that's on a mountain, but Jerusalem is the city of the king. And the king has a house there. It's called the temple. So the disciples think that Jesus is going up to Jerusalem as the king, rightly so. But they totally cannot understand what it is that the king is going to do once he gets to Jerusalem. So Jesus tells them what's going to happen to the king when he gets to Jerusalem. He tells them that the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles, the pagans. And he's going to be mocked and flogged and crucified and be raised on the third day. That is what's going to happen to the king when he goes to his holy city, when he ascends to Mount Zion. Now, this is the third prediction that we see in Matthew's gospel. And Jesus has actually been sharing with his disciples ever since that they confessed he was the Christ, right? Ever since Matthew 16, he began to share with his disciples what is going to happen to the king. What is going to happen to the Messiah? What is going to happen to the Christ? The king is going to suffer. The king is going to be rejected. The king is going to be betrayed. Here, he gives us the most detail about what is going to happen. He's going to be delivered over to the Gentiles. He's not going to Jerusalem to defeat the Gentiles. He's going to be delivered over to the Gentiles. He's going to be mocked and flogged and crucified. So here we see, as they approach Jerusalem, perhaps even with the city behind them, looking up to it, Jesus telling them what is going to happen. And perhaps the most striking thing about this is that he describes this with that terminology of the Son of Man. It is the Son of Man that will be delivered over to the chief priests. Not using the language of Messiah, or not using the language of the Christ, but it's the Son of Man. And unless we can, you know, we don't want to confuse ourselves here and say, well, this must be a different figure. If we remember the context of where that language of Son of Man comes from, I think we looked at it when we were in Matthew 16, it comes actually from Daniel 7. Daniel 7 tells us about the Son of Man. And what is it that the Son of Man will do? Well, this is what Daniel says. I saw in the night visions. Behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like a Son of Man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. So the Son of Man ascends to the Ancient of Days. To him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. So Daniel sees in this vision the Son of Man approaching the Ancient of Days and receiving a gift, receiving the gift of a dominion, a kingdom. One that would not pass away, one that would endure forever. All peoples and nations and languages should serve him. And yet, Jesus says, this Son of Man is going up to Jerusalem to be delivered over. So how can it be, how can such a glorious figure be subject to such atrocities, to such humiliation, to be mocked and flogged and crucified, to be exposed to such pain? How could it be? How could one who receives an everlasting dominion and an eternal kingdom, how can he be crucified? I think because the Son of Man is also the suffering servant. So we see not two distinct figures, we see one figure, one person who puts all of these things together for us. So, I don't know what you would expect would follow such a prediction by Jesus. But the disciples seize the opportunity that's been presented to them by this prediction. And they think, yeah. Give me a seat of honor in your kingdom. So that's what happens. That's what happens next. So on the way to Jerusalem, Jesus predicts his death. And now the disciples, they want to know about power and authority. And in fact, Jesus tells them about something far different, about service. So Jesus told his disciples basically for the last time what is going to happen to him in Jerusalem. Now he is going to tell them why it is going to happen to him. But first of all, there's a question about authority. And probably what is the most incongruous transition in Matthew's gospel, a question is now posed to Jesus by the mother of the sons of Zebedee, of James and John. Now look at what she asks. The mother of the sons of Zebedee came to him with her sons, and kneeling before him, she asked him for something. And he said to her, "What do you want?" Now, I don't know how we should read this question. It's really only a couple words in the Greek, and we could read it as this: "What do you want?" Or, "What do you want?" Or maybe all three. What do you want? Okay, I don't know. Enough of that. So she said to him, "Say that these two sons of mine are to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left in your kingdom." So, again, to describe this for you, Jesus has just told his disciples, just finished talking about his betrayal, his trial, his crucifixion, and this mom comes up, kneeling before him, feigning humility, and asks if her sons, her two precious boys, can have positions of authority and of power and honor in his kingdom. Now, does that make any sense whatsoever? No, it doesn't. It doesn't make any sense. I think we're supposed to see that this is absurd in light of what Jesus has just said. Now, of course, in their minds, it makes perfect sense because he is the king and the king is going to Jerusalem and they expect the king to accomplish his victory. And they expect the king to hold a banquet in honor of his victory. And they expect, or at least they want, to have those two seats at the end of the table. With Jesus at the head of the table, they want those two seats on either side of him so that they can drink in honor of the king's victory. And then they can be first among the 12 and whoever else comes next. Jesus has just told them that they're actually going to sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. So it doesn't necessarily, it's not insane. But they still are not thinking. There is no concept in their, there's no room in their heads to think of what it must cost them in order to achieve that place of honor and dignity. Jesus knows full well what it's going to cost him. And yet in the minds of these two brothers and their mom, who, you know, always wants the best for her boys, they have no concept of the suffering that is necessitated by the glory that Jesus will achieve. So we don't know exactly if she had, doesn't seem like she was privy to that conversation. It says here in verse 17 that he took the 12 disciples aside. So even if they were a part of a larger group going up to Jerusalem, he pulls his disciples aside on the way and tells them what's going to happen. But the disciple, these two disciples are even with their mother when she goes and asks Jesus this question. So they would have at least known what Jesus was saying, but they cannot understand it. So Jesus, who has often acquiesced to desperate mothers, please save my daughter. This mother now comes in desperation and kneels before him and asks for a special privilege for her children, her boys. So how is Jesus going to respond? I think he responds in basically three different ways. So Jesus answered, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink?" And they said to him, "We are able." He said to them, "You will drink my cup, but to sit at my right hand and at my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father." So first of all, he responds by telling them that they basically have no idea what they're talking about. You do not know what you are asking. This question then reveals their own ignorance. Give us a seat. Position us at your right hand and your left hand in your kingdom. Asking that question reveals how dumb the disciples actually are, how ignorant they actually are, how they do not actually have any sort of understanding about what it actually costs to have those positions of honor. You do not know what you are asking. Now look at how this passage continues. So he knows here, even though it's the mother that asks the question, he approaches it as if it's the disciples that are asking the question. So the "you" there, "you do not know what you are asking," is actually plural. So he's saying that the question, he's basically seeing the question that is being asked, not as if it is the mother asking the question, but as if it's the mother and the disciples, James and John. This is their request, because Jesus is now going to ask them a question of his own. And they are the ones, those two, James and John, are the ones who are going to answer it. Now, I think that their ignorance, and just the reality of their ignorance here, I think it's, we should understand it in a couple different ways. So on the one hand, we could say that it's reasonable for them to ask this. Jesus has just told them that they're going to have thrones in the regeneration. When the Son of Man sits on his glorious throne, they're going to sit on thrones as well. So then it would be reasonable for them to ask for these, you know, maybe they're bigger thrones or they're more important thrones, or at least at his right hand and his left hand, they're seats of honor within his kingdom. So it seems reasonable for them to ask for it based upon that. But it's not reasonable at all, and I think that's why Jesus responds in the way he does, because they do not understand what it will cost them to actually sit on those thrones and have those places of honor. You do not know what you are asking. Now, I can imagine that the disciples, even these two disciples who seem to have been a part of the inner group of the disciples, right? We have Peter, James, and John that actually go with Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration. So they're actually privileged to see Jesus transfigured before them. And yet they're not satisfied with just being a part of that inner three. They actually want something more. And I can imagine that they would have these sort of discussions. We've already seen in chapter 18 that they've argued about who is the greatest in the kingdom and who is actually going to have the most significant place within the kingdom of God. So they're already arguing and having these conversations. But yet, none of them want to approach Jesus on their own and ask him for these special seats of honor. So they send their mom to do it for them. And I imagine that this statement that Jesus actually The way that he responds, "You do not know what you're asking," reveals that they don't understand what it's going to cost them. They don't really understand what they need to do in order to achieve these seats of honor. I think of it like, your three-year-old asking to drive your car. They see daddy driving the car, and it looks easy. And they think to themselves, well, I can do that. So they ask. And they ask in their ignorance, because they don't know what it takes to actually drive a car. They can put their hands on the wheel, yes, and sit on daddy's lap, but they can't touch their feet can't touch the pedals. They don't know how to look in their mirrors. They don't know how to anticipate what other drivers are going to do. They don't know the rules and the laws of actually driving within our state. They don't know anything. They are completely ignorant, and yet they think that they can do it. I think that actually hopefully describes what these disciples are thinking. And they respond to the question that Jesus asks now, "Are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink?" They respond immediately, "We are able." Are you able to drink this cup that I am going to drink? Yeah, we can do that. Well, if you can drink it, then certainly we can drink it. So that is the second way that Jesus responds. So why does Jesus go here? Why does he ask this question? "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink?" It seems to have nothing to do with his kingdom, nothing to do with the seats of honor, sitting at his right hand or his left. It seems to have nothing to do with the question that they're seeking an answer to. And I think the intention behind this question is to demonstrate for the disciples the necessity of suffering before glory. All they can think of is glory. All they can think of is honor. All they can think of is power and authority. And yet Jesus, by asking this question, actually demonstrates something more. What is necessary? Well, can you drink the cup that I am going to drink? And that just opens up another question. Well, what cup is he talking about? It's hard to know exactly what the disciples are thinking by this question. They respond, they're able. So they must have understood what Jesus was getting at least in a partial sense, right? I mean, we don't really know what they're thinking. What cup Jesus is referring to? Was this the cup of God's salvation? The cup of God's blessing? The cup of God's wrath? Was this the cup of curses? Or are they thinking merely of the Passover meal? The cup that Jesus will share with them as they sit down on that night? It's hard to say. It's not really about the cup that's important, but what is in the cup? What is Jesus going to drink? And whatever it is that they think Jesus is going to drink, they think they will be able to drink. So I don't think they were thinking in their own minds that Jesus was going to drink the cup that is filled with God's wrath. But I do think that's what Jesus is referring to. Let me tell you why. Well, the context. What did Jesus just say is going to happen to him when he gets to Jerusalem? He's going to be delivered over. They're going to condemn him. He'll be given to the Gentiles, mocked and flogged and crucified. That's what Jesus thinks is going to happen to him when he gets to Jerusalem. And what else is he going to say in the following verses? Well, he's going to say the reason for his coming. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. That is, to give his life as a ransom for many. So all throughout this, sandwiched between these two ends here, Jesus is referring to the cup that he's going to drink. And when we look at the imagery of cup, Metaphorically, I mean, it could mean a lot of different things. There is an emphasis upon the cup being a cup of blessing, wine in its fullness, in its maturity, being a blessing to those that partake of it. We can also see in the imagery, especially from Isaiah 51 and Jeremiah 25 and Psalm 75, that the cup is actually given over to the Gentiles and to the Jews in Jerusalem is a cup that is full of God's judgment. And those who drink of that judgment get drunk and vomit and stagger. So God in his cup is pouring out his judgment upon the nations or the cities, Jerusalem and the Gentiles. And yet Jesus says, this cup is the cup that I am going to drink. Even looking at his prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane, what does he say? Let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. And Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done. That's Matthew 26. So what is Jesus anticipating? He's anticipating the cup of judgment, the cup of God's wrath, the cup that he is going to drink on behalf of his people. So when he asks the question, are you able to drink this cup? And they say, yeah, we're able to drink it. They have no idea what he's talking about. You do not know what you're asking. And yet Jesus knows full well what he's asking. His eyes are wide open. So instead of rebuking them for their ignorance, their overconfidence, or their immaturity, Jesus answers their question. He affirms their answer. You will drink this cup. You will drink my cup. Now I think if we understand this correctly, this is probably one of the most terrifying verses in the Bible. Jesus is anticipating drinking the cup of God's judgment, and his disciples ignorantly say, yeah, we're going to share in that cup with you. And he says, you are going to drink it. You will drink this cup. Now, I think there's a difference that's taking place here. We know that what Christ has accomplished on the cross in drinking the cup of God's wrath is a substitutionary atonement. He is taking the place of his people. He is drinking that cup on their behalf. And we know that what the disciples will do as they drink this cup, that it is not a substitutionary atonement, but it is suffering nonetheless. They will suffer. That's what Jesus is saying. Now, whether or not this means martyrdom, we're not sure. But what happened to James in Acts 12? Well, Herod killed him with a sword. That's what happened to James. Did James drink the cup? I'd say so. What happened to John? Well, John's death is not recorded in Scripture. Did he die as a martyr in 69 AD in Jerusalem? That's what Papias says, or did he die in old age in Ephesus? We don't know. But John, nonetheless, considers himself to be a partner in the tribulation while he's exiled in Patmos. That's what Revelation 1 says. So what was inconceivable to them, what they could not anticipate at all, is this suffering that is set aside for them, that is prepared for them as the followers of Christ. So Jesus tells them that they're going to drink the cup. They're going to suffer just as the Son of Man suffered. Not in a redemptive, substitutionary type of way, but as they are grafted into Christ, as they share in his sufferings, so that they would enter into his glory, they will suffer. And it appears to be that will cost them their lives. And that is the cost of discipleship. If anyone would come after me, let him take up his cross and follow me. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you. So he tells them that they will drink the cup. And even though they drink the cup, they follow him in his suffering, their position of honor that they seek is not guaranteed, right? That's what he seems to imply. That is the prerogative, that's the privilege of the Father. To sit at my right hand and at my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father. So again, even in this, Jesus is demonstrating his submission to the Father's will. I cannot appoint you to these places of honor. You will die, you will suffer on my behalf. You will follow in my footsteps as my disciples. Yet it is the Father who has actually prepared these places of honor for those that he's chosen. It's his privilege to bestow this honor upon those that he's chosen. So then, the response that Jesus gives this woman is basically set to undermine, or designed to undermine, their misconception that they are actually going to achieve glory and honor without the cost of suffering and self-denial, without the cost of death. And they think that's what Jesus is going to do, and they think that's what is going to happen with them as well. So now, after that exchange has taken place, now the other disciples hear about it. And how do you think that they responded? So, verse 24. When the 10 heard it, they were indignant at the two brothers. So they hear this conversation taking place. Maybe they see the actions of the mother of Zebedee or the wife of Zebedee. We don't know. But they hear about it somehow. Word gets out. And they are ticked off, indignant. They're fit to be tied. Now, why do you think they're angry? Are they angry at the selfish ambition of James and John? or are they angry because they actually asked the question first? They actually approached Jesus first and, you know, sought out those positions of honor. They had enough courage to approach Jesus through their mom and ask him for these places of honor. I don't think they're angry at the presumption of James and John. I think they're probably angry because the two brothers asked the question that they wanted to ask. Because those two brothers were seeking what they themselves were seeking. Who doesn't want to have positions of power and honor, right? Who doesn't want to sit at Jesus' right hand and left hand? So Jesus, you know, pops his knuckles and he recognizes that this is a golden opportunity. This is a teaching moment. This is why we homeschool our kids. So we can seize these moments and use them as a way to instruct and teach and encourage and exhort and rebuke. So he sees the 10 get angry at the two, and he calls them aside. Come here. Let me tell you guys again. And he reminds them first here of what they actually know, what they're familiar with. You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority. This is the authority, the power that they know, that they're familiar with. This is what they're used to seeing, right? They're used to seeing rulers domineering by force and strength and threat. They're used to seeing those that kind of demonstrate a mastery over other people. And this is most likely the authority that they sought. We want to rule. And Jesus reminds them that this is the way that the Gentiles rule and the great ones rule. They lord it over them. They domineer. They exercise authority over them. This is what they're associated with. And this is their way. This is how they thought of power. This is how they thought of ruling. This is what they think they're going to do of their own people, since that's what Jesus told them they would do. They would sit on 12 thrones and they would judge, make decisions, settle arguments, bring the hammer down or the sword if necessary. Not that they would go out and be witnesses to Jesus' death and resurrection, but that they would just wield the sword. So Jesus reminds them of what they know, and he goes on and tells them very distinctly, "It shall not be so among you." That ain't gonna happen. That is not the way that you are going to rule. Look at this. Look at the Gentiles. Look at the Romans. Look at Herod. And that's not it. That is not the way you're going to rule and exercise authority. "It shall not be so among you, but whoever would be great among you must be your servant, must be your deacon. And whoever would be first among you must be your slave," your doulos. "Even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." So what determines their greatness? Their service. What determines their honor? Whether or not they will be a slave. Their priority and their placement is determined by their service. Now, why is that? Well, because that's what Jesus came to do. He came not to be served, but to serve, to give his life as a ransom for many. He came not to be waited on, but to do the waiting on. He came not to have his disciples wash his feet, but to wash their feet. He came to be a ransom, not to be ransomed. He came to drink the cup, but not to pour it out on someone else. That's where true greatness lies. That is the pathway to honor and to glory. Not in positions and appointments, but in these positions of humility, service, sacrifice. This is what Jesus came for and what the disciples could not grasp. Humility, service. I think we'll save that for someone else. So notice a few things about this statement here. First, we see the purpose of Christ's service. Why is it that he came? Why did he come? I mean, this is a very singular purpose. He came, the Son of Man, right? Remember that glorious, exalted figure who approaches the Ancient of Days and who is worshipped by all peoples and languages, who receives an eternal dominion and kingdom. That Son of Man came to serve. What other ways could you finish that statement? What did Jesus come to do? Yeah, there's probably other verses that you could come up with where Jesus actually describes his purpose. But here, his purpose is singular. He came to serve. Now notice how his service is actually defined. He came to serve, that is, to give his life as a ransom for many. Now think about Jesus. And think about how often he is actually appealed to as this standard of morality and of service and love. Think about all of that. And even the world, in one sense, loves Jesus if they can just confine him to an example of morality. Jesus is just a really good guy. I mean, no one's going to argue with his ethic. He just loved everybody, tax collectors and prostitutes. And he just really had compassion. He really just cared for people. He was willing to get involved in their messy lives and take time out of his busy day to be with them, and from the little children to the old widows. Jesus was there for them, and he just really loved people. Now, we would get it extraordinarily wrong if that is all that we say about his service. If Jesus is just a really nice guy that loves people and has compassion, and that's all we say about him, then we miss the point entirely. Jesus himself defines his service not as being nice to people or having compassion, but as a substitutionary, as one who would give his life as a ransom for many, as one who would give his life as a payment for the sins of many. What did he come to do? That's what he came to do. He came to give his life as a ransom for many, to pay the price so that many could be redeemed, bought back. So that is how Jesus defines his service. His service is defined by his sacrifice. He came to die, to lay down his life, to give his life as a ransom for many. That is the purpose for his service. And I think that we see here enough that this service, this sacrifice, is sufficient and substitutionary. To give his life as a ransom for many, or in the place of many. He takes their place. He dies their death. He pays for their sins and redeems them and saves them. So, why is it that the Son of Man goes to Jerusalem to be betrayed, to be handed over to the Gentiles? On the one hand, we could read that and say this is just merely a prediction. And Jesus, as this passive victim going to Jerusalem, says, this is what's going to happen to me. Sorry, guys. But no, that's not the case. Because he says that the purpose for his coming was actually to do that, to be, in one sense, the victim, to be the one who took the place for others. So it's not just what will happen to Jesus, it's why that's going to happen. And that is the point. He came to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. He came willingly, freely, actively to give his life as a ransom for many. As one who lays down his life for his friends, as one who gives his life for his enemies, as one who drinks the cup of wrath so they can drink the cup of blessing. That's why Jesus came. So then the question is, what will it actually take for the disciples to understand this, to grasp this? What will it take for them to see that service and sacrifice lead to honor? That service and sacrifice cannot be avoided, but has actually been prepared for them, that they will drink that cup. So what will it take? What it will take is that their eyes will have to be opened. And these final verses of chapter 20 here give us another compelling scene. The journey to Jerusalem continues. And now they go out of Jericho, just miles from Jerusalem. And now they're accompanied by a great crowd. They're heading up, and they got a whole lot of people with them. Not just going to, you know, just to celebrate the Passover, but going to take over the city. Here we go. The king is coming. So this multitude joins ranks with the disciples, and they join him on the ascent up to Jerusalem. And while on their way to Jerusalem, Jesus passes two men. Two men that hear that Jesus is passing by and who call out for mercy. Lord, have mercy on us, son of David. And the crowd rebukes him. Now, we have an important mission here. We're going to Jerusalem with the king. And Jesus does not have time for you. Interesting that in the next section, we see that the crowd is the ones that are crying out, Hosanna, son of David. Right? So they actually join in the chorus of the two men here. But that gets us further than we need to go. So the crowd rebukes them, and then the men, they respond all the more eagerly. They cry out all the more, Jesus, Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us. They're asking for the king to have mercy. And Jesus stops and asks them a question. What do you want me to do for you? And they asked for their eyes to be opened. And Jesus, in pity, touched their eyes, and immediately they recovered their sight and followed him. Jesus gave them sight. He healed their eyes. They were no longer in darkness, but in the light, and they became his disciples. So, what will it take for the disciples to understand what the Son of Man is going to do? To understand the nature of the kingdom he's going to establish? To see that the last will be first, and the first last? Well, it will take a miracle. Their eyes will have to be opened. Now, I don't think it's a coincidence that Jesus just happens to have a conversation with two men who approached him and asked him a question about greatness, and then have Jesus encounter two men who ask him a question about healing and having their eyes recovered and healed. I don't think that this is necessarily a coincidence. And I don't think Matthew wants us to see it as a coincidence. This is not just another nice example of how Jesus had compassion upon somebody in need. This is designed to help us to think about these two parallel situations. Two men asking a question, Jesus saying, what do you want? Well, put us at the positions of honor. Totally failing to understand what it is that Jesus will have to do and endure. And two other men asking for mercy, save us, Lord, son of David, you're the king. That's what that language means. And Jesus saying, what do you want me to do? Heal our eyes. Give us sight. Help us to see. I think that's the takeaway that the disciples ought to have. As they look at what is happening, their understanding of greatness and power, and they're thinking that they can actually attain that without suffering. What will it take? It will take Jesus giving them eyes to see. It'll take a miracle. It's always interesting to think of the blind people in the scriptures and understanding the irony and how they're used. They actually see more than the people that have working eyes. Same here in this case. They're not a part of the inner circle. They are sitting on the side of the road. Just sitting there. And Jesus happens to walk by them. They haven't been disciples following Jesus for 2.5 years or almost 3 years at this point. They're just sitting there and they hear that Jesus is walking by. Lord, have mercy on us. They understand, I think, at this point, far more about Jesus than the disciples do. And yet, when Jesus touches their eyes and they recover their sight, they then become his disciples. And this is what the Son of Man came to do. He came as a light for the nations, to open the eyes that are blind, to bring out the prisoners from the dungeon, and from the prison those who sit in darkness. So this is what we see the Son of Man. The Son of Man that came to suffer, the Son of Man that came to drink the cup, to drink the cup of the Father's wrath. Unlike Isaiah and Jeremiah and the prophets, interesting to read those passages. They're given the cup. They're given the cup to give then to the inhabitants of Jerusalem or the other nations. take this cup and give it to them and make them drink of it. Drink of God's judgment. We see here that Jesus does not hand his people the cup of God's wrath, but he does hand them a cup, right? This cup, this blood, it's the blood of the new covenant. Not the cup that is filled with the wine of the fury of his wrath or the cup of staggering, but the cup that is filled with his blood, the new covenant that is in his blood. And this, when Jesus hands it to his disciples, this is a cup that is full of blessing. The cup of blessing that we bless, is it not a participation in the blood of Christ? Is it not a fellowship with Christ in his blood? Now, he can do this. He can offer his disciples the cup of blessing because he came to take the cup of wrath, the cup of God's judgment. He came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. He came to do this because he came to take the cup of staggering in his own hand. He drank the wine of the fury of God's wrath for us in our place. And the only one who doesn't deserve to face God's judgment in the drink of this cup, he chose to do so for us. And he drained it. He didn't just take a sip, but he drank it down to the dregs. And now we, his people, that have been united with him, we get to drink the cup of blessing, the cup of salvation, the cup that says, it is finished. So now we'll partake of that cup in remembrance of him. Of two men come up and help pass out the bread and the wine, and then we'll partake together in a moment.